Judiciary Committee together today. It's about 1:36 to 1:37. We have Senator Olson, Senator
Chairman.
Good afternoon. Senator Dyson, Senator Wilkowski, Chairman Coghill. Judiciary Committee, last day of January?
Second to last day.
Second to last day.
Yep.
I was ready to quit. We have before us the Attorney General today, and we'll listen to the Attorney General give an overview to, as best you can, as your satisfaction. What I'd like to do also after that is bring up the Senate Bill 22, which is your crimes and on sexual abuse and trafficking. So we'll have the Department of Law come up and present that after you're done. But I want to leave plenty of time for those on the committee to ask questions, give you ample time to kind of give a brief overview, Department of Law. Some of the things that you may see are coming our way that we need to be prepared for, and maybe some of the successes over the last year.
Okay.
Attorney General.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mike Garrity. For the record, I'm the Attorney General. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today and give you an overview about the department. I'll note that three of the four members were on the State Affairs Committee, and I testified last week at some length on matters of that were ongoing with the department, particularly with respect to the federal government and some of the federal issues. I'm going to not get into that again, but Senator Olson, if I'd be happy to meet with you privately or with your staff to kind of give to go over that material and that information, but today I was going to try to shift in a different direction and not repeat myself, but I would make that offer. That's a standing offer, so please don't hesitate to let me know. And Senator, I just want to acknowledge you asked a question last week for some information. I'm working on that, and we're going to have that to you in the 2 weeks, if not sooner. So I just want to acknowledge that request as well. Reasonable question. The chairman had a nuance or another feature of that, so we're trying to compile that information. We'll get that to you very soon. So I appreciate your patience.
Attorney General, just for what it's worth, we have been joined by a class from North Pole, their close-up class, and they may not totally understand the position of the Attorney General in Alaska. If you wouldn't mind, on your introduction, just kind of let them know kind of where you sit in the world of the government.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I'm from Fairbanks. I'm happy to welcome a class from North Pole. I'm the Attorney General. Under our Constitution, I'm appointed by the governor to be, in essence, the chief legal officer for the state and for the executive department. And so the Department of Law is, and the state is involved in many different matters, from enforcing child support orders to prosecuting criminals who were caught committing crimes, to collecting money that's owed to the state, and to fighting in lawsuits to protect the state's interests or to defend the state's interests. So it's a very broad spectrum of responsibilities. And it's my job to oversee our department, which consists of approximately 280 attorneys and over 500 employees, and seeing that those functions are fulfilled. There's four main core areas, and I think to segue into my presentation and of interest to the audience, but protecting Alaskans, as I mentioned, is one of the key missions that we have. Last year, our Department of Law in the criminal section handled almost 40,000 matters. That's over 20,000 misdemeanors that were referred to us, over 8,000 felonies that were referred to us, and that doesn't include, well, it does include, but to mention other facets of that is the criminal appeals that we handle. Criminal defendants, of course, have a right to appeal, and we have to respond to those appeals and defend what the jury's decided. Juvenile matters, something else included within that 40,000 or figure, petitions for post-conviction relief, a very fast-growing area over the last several years. And of course, the people sitting in prison have a lot of idle time on their hands, and so all those have to be responded to. We can't ignore them. Extraditions as well. So it's, again, 40,000 just for the criminal section and dealing. And again, those aren't all dispositions, but their matters are referred to us, and we have to devote attorney time to either screening the case. It may go to trial. It may be plea bargain. Any number of things may happen. But those, I don't mean to imply that those are dispositions, but they're matters that require our time and attention. One of the other key areas we do is ensuring fiscal integrity. That's companies who do business in the state may owe the state money for taxes, royalties, environmental damage if they have a spill or something like that. And that's something that we take very seriously. This last year, very long, protracted proceeding we had with BP arising over the oil corrosion or corrosion spills that occurred in 2006 was culminated in an arbitration in 2012, and the state was successful in that arbitration to the tune of $255 million approximately. So that's part of what we do, as well as assert those claims and take them to trial if necessary. Fostering, or promoting, the third one I mentioned is promoting good governance. This is something that's vitally important to all of us. It's a third core mission that we have. And finally, the fostering the responsible development of our natural resources. Last week, to the Senate State Affairs, I testified at length about some of the federal friction issues, I'll call them, that we have with the federal government in a variety of topics. And I don't want to repeat that. The chairman asked for trends that I see coming, and I guess I would say probably more of the same. But I do want to point out that it is it's a nuanced picture, really, and it's not always adverse to the state. And we work with the federal government on probably in a surprising number of matters, and they're sided with them. So to me, it's not a doctrinaire or dogmatic type of thing. It really depends on what the issue is. So there's nothing knee-jerk about it. But for example, the Point McIntyre rail extension, that was something that the Surface Transportation Board approved, issued a permit for following a NEPA, which is the National Environmental Protection Act, a NEPA process. And they got the permit, the railroad got the permit to construct the line. They were poised to start. I don't know if they were going to get started actually this year, but a number of non-governmental organizations or NGOs intervened in that thing and petitioned the Ninth Circuit, challenged it in the Ninth Circuit, actually got an injunction in the Ninth Circuit to stop that construction. We intervene in that thing and to support the EPA that had taken the position that everything was proper and all the steps had been taken, and along with the railroad, who's also directly involved, obviously, we petitioned and intervened in that thing, and we're sided on the same side with the federal government supporting what they'd done. And the injunction, I'm happy to say, was lifted a couple of months ago, and we hope construction will start this year. So there's an example of where we are side with the EPA and the federal government from time to time, depending on the situation. Another example, Apache Oil has got some leases in Cook Inlet and is seeking to drill there. They applied for permits and jumped through all the hoops they needed to do to get started, and they were issued incidental harassment authorizations, or IHAs, by NMFS, the National Marine Fisheries Service, for beluga whales in Cook Inlet. And again, they complied with the law and the regulations and got permission to proceed. But again, a number of NGOs sued to stop that action, saying that the NMFS was wrong to issue these IHAs, as it were. Again, we joined and intervened in that case to support what NMFS has done. This is an agency that we're adverse to many times in the Endangered Species Act cases, but when they take steps and act in what we believe is compliance with the law and permit applicants act in compliance with the law, we step in, not we don't leave it to them. We step in and actively join in those cases to support what they've done. That case is still pending, but it's one that we're involved in. Another one, the Shell, you know, the whole history of how Shell came to drill in the Arctic. There's a number of cases, challenges to that. I met with Secretary Salazar last March in Washington, D.C., and I did not take the opportunity to take him to task for anything. Maybe I should have in hindsight, but at the time, I gave him credit for the fact that we were on the verge of drilling in the Arctic. And the Secretary did what he could. That process maybe could have occurred much sooner, and I'm sure people can criticize the pace of that whole effort. But nonetheless, they did issue the permits, and those were challenged in numerous steps, and the state, again, intervened in several of those matters before the Ninth Circuit. One is still pending, but there's no injunction to prevent them from going forward. And so I think, again, there's some credit deserved there for allowing that process to go forward, albeit maybe more protections and taking more time than we would have liked. But nonetheless, I mean, I don't know that we can control everything, and I think they deserve some credit for that, and that's what I try to convey to the Secretary, notwithstanding many other issues we have with them. So another one, and this is just a lawsuit that was just filed yesterday, as a matter of fact, that Federal District Court in Washington, D.C., which is challenging the actions of the North Pacific Fisheries Council and the National Marine Fisheries Service in ceding federal waters to the state for salmon fisheries management. These are areas in Lower Cook Inlet off of Unimak Island, and there's a third area in the Prince William's Copper River Flats area, pardon me. Mm-hmm. Now, the state has exclusively regulated this area in the past, though it includes federal waters, but Congress passed a law a few years ago requiring amendments and updates to the fisheries management plans that are in place all over. And NMFS went along with the state's proposal with a formal amendment that was submitted by the state to allow the state to continue management in these areas and to not put them under federal control. The plaintiffs, which is the United Cook Inlet Drifters Association, the Cook Inlet Fishermen's Fund, have sued NMFS in federal district court, arguing that NMFS actions in allowing state management in these federal waters is a violation of the Magnuson-Stevens Act. Again, I made a decision today that we are going to intervene in that case to support what NMFS has done, to support the decision to allow the state to continue management in those areas. So I see that trend continuing, Mr. Chairman, in the sense that there are going to be other matters. And it happens to be the case that when the EPA, be it BLM, NMFS, issues a decision that goes in the state's favor, there are organizations that are aggrieved by those decisions. We have a long tradition in our government of using the courts to redress your alleged grievances, to petition the courts to redress your grievances. I think it's an important tradition, if not a right, in many statutes. And so when it goes in our favor, they're going to be challenged, and we have to intervene. When they go against us, we're going to challenge those as well. And I don't really see that abating, to be quite honest with you. But I'm not sure, as I mentioned last week, I'm not sure that our situation is any different from many other states in that respect. So, and even in sheer numbers, I'm not sure we have more of those than other states. But I do think it is a trend that will continue, and something that we have to spend time and resources and energy on. But we're happy to do it. But I do want to acknowledge that the relationship with the federal government is sometimes more nuanced than some of us like to think, or than the pundits and commentators like to think and or give credit for. So all I can tell you is that we're not going to do anything by reflexive action or some kind of knee-jerk reaction. Everything's evaluated on its merits, and where we think they're right, we support them, and where we think they've strayed, from the law, we're going to challenge him, and I think that progress will continue. I don't have other questions. I'd be happy to go on, but I mean, I think, as I said, I don't want to repeat myself, and again, I renew my offer to Senator Olson. We are adding some positions this year in the criminal section. Prosecutor in Fairbanks, one in Bethel, one in Southeast here. So you know, we take that responsibility very seriously. But otherwise, I think we're going to continue on as we've been doing and fight the battles where they come up. So I'd be happy to answer questions, but I know that the committee's time is valuable, and there's a crime bill we want to address at some point as well. But I'm
Well, I appreciate you coming before us, Attorney General, and I'm hoping that we can have you in front of us on a couple of other things, maybe even on some invited testimony. So, but having that top view is very important. Senator Dyson has a question.
Yeah, it's really a comment and a commendation. I've been very interested in Medicaid, Medicare fraud for a long time. Huge problem nationally, and I would be surprised if we've escaped it here. I've met with one of the prosecutors you have chasing that, and I'm very impressed. And Bill Stewart at Health and Human Services says that guy's nailed more corrections in 6 months or whatever it is than the previous 2 years. And I was impressed with how knowledgeable he is, and so on. I wanted to commend you for that. Well, I think our Medicaid budget is something like 1.4 million. And if what's happening nationally is true, the amount of fraud would be somewhere between 200 and 400 million. Very significant numbers for us. And I commend your efforts. And I think that those kind of things are one of those cost-benefit things where front-end loading the investigations and nailing the bad guys pays huge dividends in real dollars. And if indeed you could see the way forward to justify, you know, extra staff to nail the crooks sooner, I think the national statistics said it was a huge payback. But anyways, I'm impressed, and I commend you for that. And I'd love to see you have more resources. And every time somebody goes to Medicare or Medicaid office, most of these are, by the way, are provider frauds.
Yes.
And it's a huge industry.
Yes.
But anyway, I'd like to see them get a lot more publicity. And I'd love to see them on above the fold on the second page hanging by their thumbs somewhere. Which is one of the functions of the law, deterrent. Anyways, thank you.
Well, thank you, Senator. I share your views about it. I think it is a huge problem, and I think it is a problem up here. And I've had met with our prosecutor who's handling that and given him my expectations. I believe we get a grant from the federal government to fund the Medicare fraud unit in part.
The federal government. This is Rick Sabodney. The federal government pays 75%, and the state pays 25%.
But so we have responsibilities to them, and I've met with the federal auditors as well, and made my views known to them and our intentions, and they watch us as well. So it's something we need to do just to be good law enforcement, good prosecutors, but it's also something that the federal government is looking for a return on the monies that it invests as well. So it's a big problem, and I'm all for deterrence, and I think the way to do that is, in those kind of cases, is to, you know, give them the publicity and the profile that they deserve, and let others see what happens when they go astray and waste those dollars. And I agree, it's mostly on the provider side, and that's where, you know, we should devote our resources. Not to ignore the other type, but I mean the big one to me is the provider fraud. So I appreciate the comments, and we'll continue in that vein. We get away from that. There's other things besides the conventional crime we all think about. These financial crimes are just as important, not more important, and I think it engenders disrespect for the system and respect for law enforcement when people see, you know, other financial crimes are getting a slap on the wrist, and So I just, it's very important on a number of levels. I appreciate that.
Senator Olson also has something.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I applaud you for your energy and efforts and thoughts and ideas about getting into all these fracases and battles that are out there. But even if you do jump into something that's too deep and you're breathing through a snorkel and you ask for a snorkel extension, sometimes that isn't even enough. As you look at all the resources that are being spent on getting involved with these cases that do have some type of state involvement, there's going to be a time where you're going to be running out of resources. And with the thought that over the next several years we're going to be in deficit spending, how are you going to be able to curtail some of the activities that I hear you're getting involved with, which are many times involving federal issues that sometimes are over our area of expertise and certainly affecting other states? How do, I guess I see getting involved, but with and you're talking about bringing on more people, I guess I'm wondering what kind of judgment are you going to be using to go ahead and decide what you're going to, choosing your battles essentially, as opposed to getting involved with everything that's out there?
Well, thank you, Senator. I mean, I think choosing your battles is always going to be important, whether we have the resources or not. I mean, I wouldn't choose battles simply because I have the resources to pick a fight. I mean, I choose battles because it's the right fight. And frankly, if, you know, we'll stretch to make it work, it all goes to the merits and what we're fighting for. So I don't, you know, within reason, you've got to have people and so on. But those, to me, are not economic decisions. They're decisions that, in my view, if we have to protect the state's interest, and, you know, I'm not fighting the federalists just simply because it's a federal action or federal agency. We're fighting the federal action because it affects the state in a way that I think is wrong and not in compliance with what they should be doing. So I don't, and the additional people we're getting are not to fight those fights. The additional people we're asking for are criminal, to deal with the criminal section. So I'm not asking for any people this year to go after those things. We have a large department. I think we've got superb attorneys and great resources. Although I spent some time, and again, I'm happy to meet with you in more detail, Senator, but we do these things internally. We don't go hire other attorneys to do it, with the exception of endangered species cases. But and those are very important to the state. All of these are very important to the state. Let me mention another one. You know, this should be experienced. It's all very recent, too, which is we've fought a lawsuit in August to challenge the Voting Rights Act, Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, that requires Alaska, of all places, to go seek preclearance from the Department of Justice to make any changes in our precincts, in our election districts, you name it. And how we, in the Voting Rights Act, you may know, Senator, was enacted back in 1965 to deal with blatant, systematic discrimination against African Americans and voting in the South, primarily. And, you know, now we've elected for the second term an African American president. I mean, I think the situation in 1965 just isn't relevant anymore. But we have this requirement, and I think this archaic and anachronistic requirement, that we still have to go get the Department of Justice approval. And, you know, you recall, you were here in the spring, and, you know, what are the districts going to be? Because we've got to get them approved by Department of Justice. We have a state redistricting panel that makes a decision. Court throws it out. They have to go back to the drawing board. The reason the court threw it out is because they were looking at Washington, D.C. and devising these districts instead of at our own state constitution. So I think that's important. I'm going to devote the resources to that because we have no business being subject to the federal government when it comes to setting our election districts. And, you know, there's a case pending before the U.S. Supreme Court right now that hopefully will decide this issue. It's going to be argued in March, Shelby County. So we filed our case, but we've stayed it. I'm not going to spin my wheels and waste resources on that case if there's a case pending in the U.S. Supreme Court that might resolve this. So we're going to stay that, hold, you know, tread water, and wait until the Supreme Court rules, which will be this term. And if they don't throw out Section 5, then we're going to get, for the reasons I've just stated, we're going to pursue that. But I have to have the judgment, and I pledge to exercise the judgment to use the resources that we've got efficiently. And, you know, I'd be happy to meet with you. The number is not that overwhelming. You'd be, I think, surprised. They tend to be higher profile cases. and to get more publicity and so on. But they're not, in terms of the resources that we have and everything that the Department of Law is involved in, they're actually a pretty small percentage. But again, I'd be happy to, you know, to talk about that in more detail and go over the kind of cases that this is. I spent quite a while in, for Senate State Affairs, and I just don't want to repeat myself. But I'm happy to discuss it with you. But I get your point, and it's a good point. But I don't think we're out of balance, and I don't think we're wasting those resources. But they do need to be applied judiciously. I agree with that.
Chairman?
Yes.
I continue. With all due respect, Mr. Attorney General, though, as you look at the 1965 Voting Rights Act, and you look at what this, and you talked about the federal government, and so going ahead and at least on a national scene, going ahead and reelecting a black, an African American here in Alaska, I would say that the sense of the difference between the haves and the have-nots have not changed that much since the 1960s when I was a kid. And I'm assuming you were around back then. And because of that, I think there has to be federal protection out there for those voting people that are disenfranchised because of their smaller numbers that are there. And I think they need to be protected. Now, I realize that we have a state constitution. But the state constitution has only been in there for the last 50 years. And so that's about the same time the Voting Rights Act was there as well. And so I tend to disagree with you that the Voting Rights Act needs to be done away with when you're talking about the voter out there in Shaktulik or up in Shishmaref, you know, and maybe you've never been there, maybe you never want to be there, and I can understand that, but I think they need to be protected as well.
Well, you're absolutely right, Senator, and I have spent some time with the Bush. I was born and raised up here, and my dad was born and raised up here. I worked in Galena for you, and I've spent time in the Bush. And you're right. Let me just clarify. The Voting Rights Act will continue. Section 5 just deals with one element of it. This Section 2 will remain intact, which is you can't discriminate against voters. You can't disenfranchise voters. It's a violation of state law, much less federal law. So I absolutely agree with you that we never want to back away from the protections out there for voters. I believe the statistics I have seen, you know, the people in the villages, natives, vote in just as high, if not higher, percentages than whites. And that's a commendation to them. And so I'm not an expert on districting, just to finish the thought. And I know what the Constitution says, but I've never been involved in the process. And I don't know how they do it. I see the end results. But certainly, if I saw that happening, systematic, intentional efforts to disenfranchise, that's something we would definitely act on, because I would abhor that just as you do, and I think it's something we need to be sensitive to. So
I think we'll set up a private meeting if that's okay with you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
I'd be more than happy to, Senator.
Thank you. Senator Wilkowski?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I too was disappointed when the administration filed the lawsuit against to overturn the federal oversight. I think that's misguided. But on a different topic, it's one that you and I have talked about. I know when you came for confirmation hearing, it's something I asked you a lot about. I know there's a lot of focus on federal issues and filing lawsuits against the federal government. One of the things that I've been concerned about over the years is making sure that we enforce the oil leases that we have. I've been convinced over the years that when I look at the rates of return, the net present values, we have the oil industry doing extremely well here. And yet we're not seeing the production that we want. And so one of the things that I posed to you when you came and sat in my office a couple of years ago for your confirmation, I posed it to you when you sat here for your confirmation hearing, was what are we going to do to make sure that we're enforcing the leases against the oil companies who, in my opinion, are sitting, some of them, not all of them, some of them are sitting on them. So how many lawsuits have you filed to protect Alaska's interests to ensure that we're getting the maximum benefit for our oil resources from our oil and gas resources?
Well, in the last year, Senator, I can't think of any. As I sit here, something may come to mind. I may have to supplement that. The one that was pending that when I took this position was the Point Thompson case, which has been settled, and as a direct consequence of several hundred Alaskans now have jobs, several hundred businesses are now getting business that wouldn't have been getting that if that case were still in litigation. So I think that's important to point out, and I think that's a risk whenever you bring those kind of cases. Point Thompson was a case of no development, and so that was a pretty easy one. It wasn't my decision, but it was there when I took the position. I would certainly investigate anything that was brought to my attention. I believe the law is that they're required to put the leases into production. They are not required to put the leases in the production to maximize the lessor's interest, which is what you're implying. They're required to put the production, the leases in production, and deal with those leases as a reasonable and prudent operator would, not put the leases in production to maximize the lessor's interest, which is what you're suggesting. Now, I'd be happy to investigate, and I would investigate, if there's information brought to our attention that there is a situation where leases are lying dormant or fallow and have not been put in production at all. But I think once they're in production, and obviously we've been, you know, experiencing oil development production up there for close to 50 years, I'm not sure what the state's powers or responsibilities would be to go beyond the fact that they're in production, and unless you can show that a reasonable and prudent operator would be doing something else with those leases, I think our options are limited. But please,
just quick follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Quick follow-up, and we're running about 5 minutes over where I wanted to be, so keep
very,
quick.
Very brief. And you're right that the responsibility, the duty is to act as a reasonably prudent operator. The second part of that obligation, though, is to, with due regard for the lessor's rights. So maybe you and I can get together and sit down, and I'd be happy to talk to you about some concerns that I have.
Well, I'd be happy to talk to you as well, Senator, and I'm far from an expert in it, but I mean, I'd be happy to have that discussion with you, and please feel free to contact my office, and we can discuss it in more length and in private, absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah, and Attorney General, I appreciate you coming and fielding a few questions, kind of off the cuff, but issues that are important to all of us in Alaska. So, and you carry quite a responsibility. So, thank you for that. There will be other conversations. I will invite you to the committee, and we'll work with your scheduling on that. I sure appreciate you coming before us and giving us that kind of overview. And what I'd like to do at this point, and if you want to make comments on it, that's fine, or you can have your department come up. But I'd like to bring Senate Bill 22 before the committee. And I know you have some who have spent their time in this. And so if you want to make some comments at the outset, this is the time.
Well, I'd like to invite Commissioner Masters to join me. And I think we have very brief comments introducing the governor's bill. And then I would turn it over to Ms. Carpinetti from the Department of Law for a little more in-depth review, Mr. Chairman. But I do want to, again, thank the committee for hearing Senate Bill 22. As I said, I just have a brief introduction, and I want to focus on the themes that are more relevant to the prosecution of serious crimes. Commissioner Masters will introduce several issues that are of significance to law enforcement, and obviously there's some overlap, but the most important theme in this bill for both law enforcement and criminal prosecution is to vigorously pursue the governor's goal of reducing domestic violence, sexual assault, and sexual abuse of children in our state. I mean, I know there's many things we probably can disagree about, but I hope we all agree on the fact that it's an epidemic in the state. We should be ashamed of it as a society, and we should be doing more to prevent it. Governor Parnell, since I took this position, has been a laser focus on this issue. It's absolutely sincere and serious about it, and I've taken the message from him, and as I'm sure Commissioner Masters has, and I think this bill just is another step to strengthening the law so that we can accomplish that goal. There's several provisions, which I'll mention. One is a recent decision by the Alaska Court of Appeals that we believe misinterpreted the legislature's intent in adopting increased ranges for persons convicted of sex felonies. I won't go into detail about it, but the opinion was unfortunate. We have a petition for review pending with our Alaska Supreme Court, but in the meantime, the bill seeks to clarify the law for purposes of future sentencing and in a way that is consistent with the legislative intent, which we think was misinterpreted. The bill also addresses gaps in sexual assault statutes to prohibit probation and parole officers from having sexual relations with people on probation and parole. There was a rather notorious case in Anchorage over this last year in which the laws, there was a bit of a loophole to prevent the state from prosecuting a person as he deserved and should have been prosecuted, and so that would close that loophole. We're also making changes in criminal procedure to protect victims of sexual assault, sexual abuse, and domestic violence. For example, requiring a hearing before a judicial officer, before a person arrested for a bail violation for a domestic violence crime can be released. We also broaden the protection for these victims from the use of evidence of past and future sexual misconduct. Finally, the last thing I want to touch on is to address a change to the immunity program that we currently have. The bill proposes to amend the procedure for addressing a witness's claim of a Fifth Amendment privilege, which, as the panel's aware, a person cannot be required to testify against their Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination. But this would change the law and the granting of immunity by the state, if it's going to happen, by requiring the trial judge to assess the credibility of the witness, and depending on what the trial judge does with their request for immunity, would allow the state to appeal that decision to a trial court in case we disagreed with it. So, again, it's all aimed at getting to the truth and going after the people responsible. But that's concludes my brief remarks, and I turn to Commissioner Masters.
Commissioner Masters.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Joe Masters, Commissioner for the Department of Public Safety, and appreciate the opportunity to be able to sit here with the Attorney General and introducing SB 22. It, as the Attorney General said, is not only a goal of the governor, but it's also a steadfast commitment of DPS, Department of Public Safety, to also do everything in our efforts to end this epidemic, and that's why I'm honored to sit here with the Attorney General. This legislation builds on this commitment by strengthening the investigative tools available to the Alaska State Troopers and other law enforcement agencies to apprehend the perpetrators of these and other related crimes. Parts of this bill is particularly useful to law enforcement, as it provides law enforcement with additional investigative tools by broadening the authority of investigators to intercept communications in sex trafficking cases. These crimes commonly require cooperation and communication amongst perpetrators, and if we have enough evidence to justify a wiretap, this bill would allow us to make that request and get the judicial authorization to do so. It also protects young people who are victims of sex trafficking or otherwise involved in prostitution, and strengthens the penalties on the demand side of sex trafficking by requiring persons who prey on these victims to register as sex offenders. It provides additional protections for victims and survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault and stalking. It allows victims of human trafficking, sex trafficking, and unlawful exploitation of a minor to apply for violent crimes compensation. Finally, this bill helps in the investigation of child pornography cases and crimes, online enticement of a minor, and unlawful exploitation of a minor by allowing the Attorney General to designate another attorney in his office to evaluate applications that our troopers have for administrative subpoenas to obtain business records from ISP providers. This is important as investigation of these crimes often require quick action by law enforcement, and under current law, only the AG himself can approve them. These reasons and a myriad of others, I urge you to support this legislation. And I thank you for the opportunity to not only make brief comments, but also to sit in the introduction of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Masters and Attorney General. A very, very sobering topic, and I'm glad you put it into the themes. And I struggled with how to get kind of the themes of these bills, these really sections of the bill, in a good manner. You did a very good job of outlining that. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Unless there's other questions, again, I'd ask Ms. Carpenetti to come forward, and she can ask and provide a little more, another layer of the overview for the committee.
Thank you. And what I'm going to do is probably just take a brief at ease while we get her situated up here. So thank you. We'll just take a little break here, off record. Record. Okay, Annie, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, Annie?
Thank you. My name is Annie Carpenetti, and I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. And at the request of the chairman, I think I'll just go through and do a general summary section by section of the bill. Mm-hmm. Please interrupt me if you have questions.
Yeah, and just for the committee men, I think what I'd like to do is get as close as I can to the general overview first, because I really do believe that there are theme-based issues in here that we're going to probably have to take by way of discussion, and they probably fall into the different sections. But I didn't feel comfortable enough to introduce it that way after my third reading of it. I could not figure out how I would do that. So mm-hmm. if it develops, it develops. But in drilling down to places where there are huge policy discussions, I would only ask that we do it for clarification today, and then we'll debate it significantly as we move along. Okay. All right.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I did this morning when I looked at the bill, I looked at themes for the bill, and there were three that I saw. One the Attorney General described, and that is the governor's pursuit of some improvement in the rate of sexual assault, sexual abuse, and domestic violence in our state, and that is by far the main theme in this bill. I think also, and related, is the theme of supporting victims' rights across the board. And third, there are several sections that are addressed to making our criminal justice procedure a little bit more efficient in all respects. Sections 1, 20, and 21, and we have to sometimes take them out of order because they address the same issue. Mm-hmm. And that's the one that the Attorney General introduced, and that is unfortunately an attempt. What we're trying to do is reverse the effect of a recent decision by the Court of Appeals. It was a divided decision, 2-1, where they addressed our sentencing for felons who are convicted of sex crimes in a way that we think was not justified by the legislative intent that was part of the record, actually, in 2006, when, and I think most of you were here, when the legislature addressed the ranges for penalties for sex felonies. So these sections address the decision and try to reverse the effect of that decision.
So just for the members' edification, I put the letter of intent in the packet and the Collins case, I think is what it was.
Yes.
That you're talking about in the packet for all the members to kind of look at.
And I'd be glad to discuss the details with that. I don't know whether you want to do it now.
Probably at a later date, because I think we need to make sure that if we're going to change that decision, that it's very clear what our intention is and how we do it. Certainly, the statutory language you put in front of us would make that very clear, but I think our debate to get to that statutory language is equally important.
Section 2 would allow a victim of sex trafficking or human trafficking to bring a civil action for damages against the perpetrator of the sex trafficking or human trafficking at any time, and or in other words, to delete the statute of limitations for bringing such a civil action. Sections 3, 4, 5, and 6, the Attorney General described briefly, and that is to fill an unintended gap in our sexual assault statutes, the effect of this would be to make it a Class C felony for a probation or parole officer to have engage in sexual penetration with a person who is on probation or parole, or it make it a Class A misdemeanor for a probation or parole officer to engage in sexual contact with a person on probation or parole. And that's in response to that situation that arose in Anchorage earlier this year. The bill defines probation officer fairly broadly because, as our understanding, that the role that person had was not a traditional probation officer appointed by the Commission of Corrections, but he was an employee of ASAP, Alaska Alcohol Safety Action Program, under contract with the court to provide supervisory services to people who participate in therapeutic courts.
There's a question here, and I have a question. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does this apply only to a probation officer or parole officer who someone under their jurisdiction?
Through the chair, you mean in their direct?
Yes.
Supervision? No. Through the chair, no. It would apply to a person that probation or parole officer was reckless or knew or was reckless in regard to whether that person was on probation or parole.
So if a probation officer is married and their spouse is on parole, then we are making that a crime.
Through the chair. Actually, that's an interesting point, and it was raised by the Public Defender Agency. And it's interesting because that exception of marriage between the parties is not part of our law that prohibits a police officer, for example, from having sexual relationships with a person in their custody or correctional officers under those circumstances. But I think you're probably right. It should be addressed and accepted because we certainly don't want to make that a crime.
And then the other question, just on, it sounds like the contract parole officer is one. Does that extend into what Alaska has as third-party guardian?
Third-party custodian?
Yes.
No, okay. It doesn't. It applies to probation and parole officers, and then it defines probation and a parole officer as somebody who is who occupies the role of a probation officer, even though he or she might not be appointed by the Commissioner of Corrections.
Okay.
Section 7 fills another unintended gap in the law. There's a crime of unlawful contact in the first degree, which makes it a Class A misdemeanor if a person who is charged with a crime and a court orders that person not to have contact with the victim or witness in that particular case, and the person is released, and this condition is a condition of bail or parole or probation, it makes it a Class A misdemeanor for that person to have unlawful contact with that victim or witness. We have had a couple of cases, I think, in Fairbanks where the judge has ordered the defendant as a condition of bail not to have contact with the victim or witness, but then the defendant has been unable to bail, to meet bail, and has been in jail and constantly calling the victim or witness and exerting pressure on them. One of the cases, there were dozens and dozens of calls directing the victim to basically undermine the prosecution of the underlying case. Section 8 is part of the governor's the governor's really intent on trying to diminish the demand side of prostitution offenses, and one of the ways that we are doing that in this bill is to say to provide that property that is used in the offense of prostitution by a patron of a prostitute is subject to forfeiture. Right now, property that is used in sex trafficking offenses is subject to forfeiture, but this would, and right now, a person who commits felony-level prostitution, that is being a patron of a child who's a prostitute, can have their property seized, and this would expand that to all people, all patrons of prostitutes.
So it's a very broad description, so I'm sure we're going to be looking into that, but Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, just and I just want to get this on the record because you and I talked about this, but as I read this, this is what applied to John's, basically. It's a which is a Class B misdemeanor. Is that?
Through the chair, that's correct.
And so John picks up a prostitute in his $100,000 Mercedes-Benz, takes her to his house, his multi-million dollar house in South Anchorage, and he's basically hit with a Class B misdemeanor, which is 90 days maximum, and then he gets a $100,000 car forfeited, and he forfeits his $2 million home potentially. That's the potential ramifications of this section. Is that fair to say?
Through the chair. That's potential, yes, unlikely, but that's yes, that could happen, and that is the one of the
that is one of the issues that I came up when I put on my notes. It was, what is the scope of this, and do we want to talk about the scope of that? Mm-hmm. And just for what it's worth, my first name is John, so I don't know if that's the best way to describe that.
I use patron.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. When you come back, I'd be interested in the provisions of what you do when the guy's borrowed his brother or mother's pickup.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Senator Dyson, there are procedures for that. It's called remission, and we don't do this very often. But if a person has an automobile that the state wants to forfeit, the bank or the spouse or the brother who has an ownership interest in that piece of property can come in and say, Judge, I didn't do anything wrong. Please don't forfeit the car. And
yeah, we can come back to that.
So there is a process, and I think as we get into that, dealing with both the scope and the process are going to be things that we'll need very clear.
Yes. Section 9 removes the statute of limitations for criminal prosecution of people who have committed sex trafficking, human trafficking, and distribution of child pornography. Sections 10 and along with 24, 25, and 26 give a court the discretion. First is a condition of bail for a person who is charged with a domestic violence crime, or in terms of civil protective orders, to require a perpetrator or a defendant to carry GPS monitoring. And it requires it to be according to guidelines adopted by the Department of Public Safety. That has not been done yet, so it's something that was allowing the state to look at this, but the guidelines have not been considered at this point.
And, you know, just for as we get into the discussion on that, I'm sure the debate is going to be around the cost and what's the accountability of this, I guess. And to me, it seems like something pretty new in your bail condition. And then this is just the chairman, because I've never really delved into this law, but it looks to me like because of the criminal portion of charges and the civil, I need to understand better the civil side of that. So it looks to me like in the bill, at least what I was reading, I had a hard time disconnecting myself from the criminal behavior and how this now under protective orders, the civil wouldn't treat people like a criminal so much. But it was an accountability. So in my mind, I had a hard time with that. And I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to visit with you on it, but reading through it, I had a hard time making the transition. Just help me make the transition. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We had testimony from Corrections recently that they have a passive GPS system. And I just, maybe you could talk a little bit about what your intent is, because if the intent is to simply monitor and see if someone's going to their partner's house, And I, by the way, I agree with the intent. I mean, I think this is a good provision. I think it's important for us to figure out what our intent is. If the intent is to keep someone away from someone they've abused, we probably want to go to an active GPS system, I would think, and which is going to cost probably quite a bit of money. But so I'm just, can you talk a little bit about what the intent is and what your fiscal note looks like for this?
Through the chair, I think we will have better information for you after the Department of Public Safety looks at procedures and adopts guidelines. My understanding is, and I have to apologize because I'm not the best person to talk about modern technology, but my understanding that it would have to be active, because if the intent was to protect a victim 24/7, it would be, that would be what you would need.
Yeah.
Section 11, under current law, a person who's charged with domestic violence crime has to appear either in person or by telephone in front of a judge before he or she can be released on bail. This just expands that to a person who is out on bail in connection with a domestic violence crime. If they are arrested for a violation of bail conditions, it also requires that the person either appear by telephone or in person in front of a judicial officer before they can be released again on bail.
Senator Wilkowski has a question.
Yeah, and if you can just talk about the rationale for that. I mean, if someone violates the condition of probation by going to the victim's house, I would agree with that. If so, it's a mere technical violation, is it your intent to capture all, even technical violations of the parole or probation?
For Section 11,
Section 11.
What we're talking about is a person who's been charged with a crime, right, and who has been released on bail on conditions that the court has set in person, and then that person goes out and violates a condition. So if they are arrested, I imagine that most cases where a defendant who's out on bail and is arrested for violation of condition, it's a lot more than a technical violation. But if they are arrested for a violation of their condition of bail and taken to jail, the idea is that they shouldn't be arrested, they shouldn't be released, excuse me, under a bail schedule, but a judicial officer should personally look at that person and see why they violated and whether they're more dangerous to the victim and whether other conditions might be appropriate under the circumstances.
And that was the transition I had a hard time making, going from 10 to 11, was one was a civil issue, one was a criminal issue, and very similar issues on monitoring. That's one was there are violation possibilities of conditions of set by the court.
Mm-hmm. It's just unwise, I think, for a person who has already been released on bail on a domestic violence mm-hmm. crime and who violates the conditions of bail to be released under a bail schedule. I mean, it should be a judicial officer looking personally at that person and that violation before the person gets out again to make sure things are safe for the victim.
All right.
Section 12, the Attorney General already described it. It just expands those crimes that can be subject to a wiretap. Our law is pretty specific as to the procedures that the Attorney General must go through to get permission from a court to wiretap, but these crimes, as he said, as Commissioner Masters said, people communicate and cooperate in this type of crime, and it might be one of those cases where we would be able to get valuable evidence by wiretapping under the correct circumstances. Section 13 amends the rape shield protection for victims of sexual assault, sexual abuse, and unlawful exploitation of a minor. This is an evidentiary issue where if a defendant wants to raise or introduce evidence of past sexual conduct by a victim of a rape, sexual assault, sexual abuse, the defendant has to raise it in front of the court in camera, that is outside the presence of the jury and the public, and discuss whether or not this evidence is the relevance of these evidence outweighs the prejudicial effect or the invasion of this victim's privacy. And that's current law. This bill expands that rape shield protection to sexual conduct of a victim that occurred after the alleged crime. The bill also would require a defendant to make application for use of this evidence pre-trial rather than during the trial, unless for some reason the defendant didn't know about it. And that's something that, that we've talked to the public defender about. You don't want to cut off their ability to raise evidence that's relevant, but you want to encourage them to bring the request early so that everybody can be prepared, including the defendant and the most important, the complaining witness, to prepare for what's going to.
Senator Dyson has a question.
Yes. And
we'll get when we come back to this one, I want to explore a little bit more false accusations and how that how we deal with that. I had a foster kid, one of our state's more famous sexual exploitation. She called and said, Mr. Dyson and his wife run around the house and drink whiskey out of her shoe and several other things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the DFYS then, people said, the third time she's done that with every foster parent we put with. If I'd have gotten sent to trial on that one, you know, I'd be worried that this kid's prior pattern of doing that, you know, couldn't become evidence in my defense.
Well, through the chair, Senator Dyson, this only requires that the judge weigh these factors, the relevance and the probative value, and the be outside the presence of the jury before it's introduced. So it, you know, it gives some protection to the victim, because if the judge decides that the evidence really isn't relevant enough to be introduced, then she hasn't suffered the harm of having it introduced. But it doesn't necessarily, it wouldn't prevent evidence that is relevant.
See, that's a balancing of rights.
Which judges do all the time, yeah. Balancing of whether the probative value versus the prejudicial effect of evidence.
Senator Bilkowski had a point.
Yeah, thank you. A little concerned about that, the five-day requirement there. And I understand you have the safety valve, but I also understand that you have criminal attorneys and public defenders who are just completely overwhelmed. And when someone is on, you know, trying to balance this, I understand where you're trying to go. But at the same time, you have someone potentially on trial for their life. And if their attorney makes a mistake and doesn't give the court notification, even if they had the information available and they just forget it and give it on day four, it looks to me like they're banned from doing that. And so that's just, I just want to raise a red flag on that.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate that. And I think we can figure that one out. Sections 14, 15, 43, and 44. 43 and 44 are the court rule changes. They strengthen the procedure for a judge to determine whether a witness in a trial qualifies for a Fifth Amendment protection against testifying, and the procedure for, in cases where the judge decides that there's a Fifth Amendment privilege, granting immunity to that witness to testify. Just a couple things in our state. We have transactional immunity, not use immunity. So when we grant immunity to a witness, that means that we cannot prosecute that person for whatever he or she says, even if we have plenty of evidence from another source. They are protected. Okay.
Generally, I understand that, but help me one more time. The two immunities and just a little brief definition, transactional and?
Use immunity.
Use immunity.
Forbids the use of the evidence, of that particular evidence, but it doesn't prohibit the police from obtaining that information from another source and using it.
Okay, all right.
I think that's accurate.
I think Senator Bilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm worried about, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but as I read this, so a person has a Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination.
Correct.
And there's Article 1, Section 9, right against self-incrimination. I think it's Article 9, under the Alaska Constitution. And so under current law, a person claims their privilege, and the judge says you don't have to testify, and we're changing that to saying the person has to go and testify in the judge's chambers.
Through the chair, current law is that there's an in-camera proceeding with only the witness who is claiming the privilege, the witness's attorney, and the judge. We are not part of that procedure, nor is the defendant or the defense attorney. It's just
Right, but the attorney makes the proffer, as opposed to the witness having to violate his Fifth Amendment rights and testify, correct, under current law?
Well, right now, the attorney, that's the problem. The attorney does sometimes make the proffer, and part of the evaluation of this Fifth Amendment privilege is an evaluation of this particular witness's credibility. And if this particular witness does not say anything or participate in any way besides having his or her attorney make the proffer, the judge really isn't in a good position to make that evaluation.
And I'm sure we'll debate this more, but the Constitution is pretty clear to me. You can't be compelled to testify against yourself. The Constitution doesn't say you can't be compelled to testify yourself unless a judge finds that you're not credible. But I think this appears to me to be a violation of the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution and of the Article 1, Section 9. I'd just be curious if this has been done elsewhere or found to have been upheld elsewhere.
Through the chair, I will look at what other jurisdictions do, because it's really a thorny problem, because we as the prosecution are required to make decisions on whether or not this witness has transactional immunity to whatever he or she said without knowing what they said. So the law is presently quite clear that this evidence cannot be used for any purpose. It's sealed and cannot be used for any purpose whatsoever besides the judge making the determination of whether or not this person has a Fifth Amendment privilege. So I think that, I agree with you. It's a procedure that we need to be careful with because we don't want to be compelling people to incriminate themselves. However, when they're asking for immunity in a criminal prosecution of another person, it is important that the judge have some opportunity to evaluate the credibility of the witness that is asking for this.
The standing of a citizen, I understand giving a good answer, but then for me, I always have to answer the question in my mind, not only the constitutional question, but do I want the government to be the one that can always push that, where the individual is kind of forced to give an answer for itself. They cannot get the government to give an answer for itself. So as we go into this discussion, that's kind of how I'm going to look at it as well.
Okay. And the various other sections allow for the state to take an interlocutory appeal of the trial court's decision in this regard. Right now, we do take petitions, and generally the Court of Appeals grants them, but just to be sure, we thought it would be best to give us the right to appeal a decision to have a review by the Court of Appeals of this decision. Sections 16 and 17 are really efficiencies more than anything else, and actually they're quite limited. These sections provide that if a person has, in Section 16, has participated in a treatment program as a condition of bail release and is planning to seek credit for that treatment against any period of incarceration that may be imposed, that defendant raise that issue before the sentencing proceeding so that the court can decide it at the time when the information is fresh in everybody's minds. We've had some cases recently where the courts are parties are litigating whether or not a person gets credit for this time 10 years after the treatment, and it's so much better to bring it at a time when people understand and can award it with some assurance that it's accurate. And Section 17 is similar, but it talks about credit for treatment that may have been served as a condition of bail release on a petition to revoke probation, or as a condition of probation. It requires the defendant who is claiming credit for these periods of treatment to do so at the hearing on the disposition for the petition. Section 18 provides that a judge can impose a suspended imposition for a person convicted of human trafficking. Not that I think any judge would, but it clarifies it in law. Section 19 is a provision in our sentencing law that provides that if a defendant is being sentenced for various convictions of possession of child pornography, distribution of child pornography, or distribution of indecent material to minors, that the judge should impose at least some time, as little as 1 day, consecutive service for each crime that the person is convicted of.
Senator Wilkowski has a comment on that.
Yeah, I just want to understand Section 19. So and maybe I can give you an example and tell me if how it would be different under this law and current law. So possession of child pornography, police find someone has 100 child pornographic pictures in their possession. Under current law, is each one of those pictures considered a violation? And then would this law change that to stack it? Is that the way that?
Through the chair, it's possible that each possession could be a separate charge. Generally, what happens is they're charged in groups, because usually when they investigate these people who have this material have lots of it. Right. But we don't convict people of 100 counts of possession of child pornography.
But to be clear, there might be several different counts that their person is convicted on.
Yes.
And this would demand that some sentence structure given for each count.
For each count, yes. Some. And as little as, and it's, we have that precedent for other areas of offenses. And this is just to ask the judge to recognize that there have been several convictions, and at least a day should be imposed for each one consecutively. Sections 20 and 21 I've already discussed in connection with the Collins case. Section 22 corrects what I think was an oversight in 2006 when the legislature increased the ranges for sex felonies. It adds sex trafficking in the first degree and online enticement of a minor to the definition of sex felony in Title 12. Section 23 requires patrons of a child who has been prostituted to register as a sex offender. Section 24, 25, 26, and 27 I've already discussed. Or 27 just also is a conforming amendment. On a civil protective order right now, there's the statute requires a warning to be placed on the order itself saying that for certain violations of this protective order, you may be subject to prosecution for a misdemeanor and subject to incarceration and a maximum fine. Right now it says $5,000. In the last couple of years, the legislature raised the maximum fine for a Class A misdemeanor to $10,000. So we just added that to conform with current law regarding fines. Section 28 addresses the privilege of confidential communications between counselors in domestic violence cases and sexual assault cases by adding counselors that work on military bases to add give them the protection of confidentiality.
Sure. Senator Wilkowski has a question.
Are you looking at tightening up that definition at all?
Actually, through the chair, yes. It doesn't have a definition, and we think it probably should. Thanks for bringing it up. I appreciate it. Section 29 is the section that allows a victim of sex trafficking, human trafficking, or unlawful exploitation of a minor to apply for violent crimes compensation benefits. Section 30, along with sections 40 and 41, address the goal of making our system a little bit more responsive to the rights of victims. They require a court when sentencing a person, if the pre-sentence report does not include a victim impact statement, it requires the court to ask why or send it back and say, please explain why you weren't able to provide a victim impact statement in the pre-sentence report. It also expands the places where the judge can consider the victim impact statement in sentencing a person. And it also, and Section 30 would ask the judicial counsel to evaluate at a time when a judge comes up for judicial retention election, would ask the counsel to evaluate whether or not the judge has complied with the law in terms of victims' rights and include that in the report on the victim, on the judge's performance.
Senator Dyson has something on that, any?
Mr. Chairman, are you, is your intention to stop at 3?
Yes, we're going to, I knew this was going to happen. I knew we're not going to get through the whole bill as best we can. yes, is there something you wanted to bring up before we go?
Well, just quickly, and excuse my being slow. Bottom of page 2 and the top of page 3 of the bill itself, it seems to me to be redundant, and I would appreciate your looking at that. That can come back another time.
Oh, bottom of page 2 and line 25?
Yes, yes. 24, 25, and line 1 and 2 on top of page 3.
Oh, okay. I'll look at that. Thank you.
And Andy Carpenetti, you know, it's a rather lengthy bill, but I think you have done a good job of kind of outlining where we're at. My intention is to go ahead and stop at 3, so what we'll do is we'll pick back up, and then we'll put it open for testimony before we begin questioning the specific issues, if that's okay with you.
Sure. So what would you like me to do? Continue?
Continue on right till 3 o'clock, and where we end is where we'll pick back up, if that's okay with you.
Okay.
All right.
Section 31 provides that a person who's been convicted of a sexual felony that's an unclassified or a Class A felony does not qualify for good time, or also known as mandatory parole. Section 32, 33, 34, and 35 are the provisions in the bill that would allow another lawyer in the Department of Law, in addition to the Attorney General, to evaluate applications from law enforcement for administrative subpoenas.
Mr. Chair.
I'm sure we'll have some discussion on that.
Okay, and we can discuss that at a later time, but I just raise my serious concerns with that, as I did for the last probably 5 years.
Well, the rationale, as Commissioner Masters said, is that, you know, our Attorney General sometimes is unavailable. He goes to meetings, and these are generally issues that need to be addressed in a rather, you know, quickly, so that if there's another lawyer who's trained to evaluate these, it would certainly help law enforcement. Section 36 is actually a provision in Title 47 in civil law. And it's my understanding is, and I'm not the best person to discuss this in any detail, but federal law would require the state to, under these circumstances where the state, in a China case, asks the court to allow it to dispense with efforts to reunite a parent with a child. And then, of course, the judge has the discretion to decide whether or not he or she should, to allow the state to not make their best efforts to reunite a parent with a child under these circumstances. And that is if the parent has committed sexual abuse against the child or another child in the family, or the defendant is a registered sex offender or is required to register as a sex offender. Sections 37 and 38 would add athletic coaches to the people who are required by law to report to authorities if there is reasonable grounds to believe that a child is being abused or neglected. It defines athletic coach to include both voluntary and paid coaches. Section 39 is intended to reduce as much as possible the publishing of child pornography that is a necessary part of the criminal discovery process. And what we're trying to do is require everybody to go to the source of the material and observe it there, so the defendant and his or her lawyer goes to the police where they store it, or the prosecution does too, to look at it so that we don't have to copy it and send it again to somebody else. It has procedures to allow the court to decide how to get it out, get this material out to an expert out of state. I know the public defender in past years has had concerns because sometimes they consult out of state experts and need to get the material to them. So it allows the court to adopt procedures to get it to experts.
And it really goes to making sure that you're not kind of redistributing, but still protecting the right of all counsel to get that information.
Right. The defendants have obviously a right to look at the material. On the other hand, every time it's copied, you re-victimize the person who's in that photograph, and to the extent we can limit it, we should. Section 42 makes a really minor change to Evidence Rule 404, and I'll just try and explain it really quickly. Generally, we are not allowed to use evidence of past bad acts in a criminal prosecution. There are some exceptions to that, and they include prior acts by the defendant of sexual abuse or sexual assault of a child, sexual abuse or assault of a or sexual assault of an adult, and domestic violence cases. For some reason, the exception in for assault or abuse of a minor has a 10-year look back that the others don't have, the other exceptions don't have. And it doesn't make a lot of sense. The judge already has to weigh whether or not the relevance of this testimony outweighs whether the probative value outweighs the prejudicial value. So and especially since now, you know, people who abuse children sexually spend some time in jail, so that having a 10-year look back may not make a lot of sense if a person has just been released and has spent 10 years in jail and reoffends. You can't use that evidence, or you can't even ask the judge to weigh that evidence because of the 10-year look back. So it would remove that 10-year period.
Mr. Chair. Senator Wilkowski has something on that.
Is there a, I haven't dealt with this issue in a long time, but is there a 10-year, you're saying there's no 10-year look back at all for prior wrong acts in any other offense?
Well, generally prior bad acts you can't use at all, but the legislature has adopted these exceptions, and the other exceptions, which are sexual assault, and domestic violence crimes, there is no 10-year look back or any time look back. It's just part of the weighing process that the court does in deciding whether or not to allow the evidence to be introduced.
In which cases can you not use prior bad acts? Can you not provide evidence of prior bad acts?
In most cases, let's see. For example, somebody is charged with theft or drunk driving. You can't use the evidence that the person has been convicted 5 times of drunk driving, or has already been convicted of theft or other crimes involving dishonesty. You can't use that evidence generally.
Do you think that's a good policy in other areas?
And let me correct myself. There are other exceptions to the use of prior bad acts. If you can convince a court that there are other reasons like preparation, intent, knowledge, or absence of mistake, you can ask the judge for the permission to use prior bad acts. I guess I'm sort of convinced by the reason that they're not allowed, and that is it's evidence is too good. We want to convict a person for what they've done this time, not necessarily for their past, with some exceptions. I don't know whether other people would agree with me on that, but I think there's good reasons for the general. There's a good reason for the general rule.
Yeah, the double jeopardy question rises, right?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think one of the rationales for this rule is that, you know, if you've been convicted and you've paid your debt to society,
right,
there are reasons why you shouldn't have to have that introduced. I don't know whether other prosecutors would agree with that, to tell you the truth.
Even parents struggle with that one.
Pardon?
Even parents struggle with that one.
Yeah, not so much. Not me. I don't know. Do you disagree with me? Oops.
Just taking the fifth.
So I think that the remaining sections I've already discussed in connection with other sections. So
what I'd like to do next time, and especially for those who are here who expect to testify on the bill, my expectation is the next time we bring this bill before us, we'll let you open, and then we'll give some public testimony time, and then I would like to go through again to those questions that were raised. We know there are going to be some areas that are going to be tougher,
sure,
some areas that will be probably, like you say, good management issue questions. So I want to debate the issues I think that are the more important ones so that we don't spend a lot of time on it. But then my expectation is to try to move this bill along, not to sit here and, you know, to beat it to death. But so for public testimony next time, after your brief comments to introduce, and then after public testimony, my intention is for us to work into the bill, drill down to those places where we think we need to either have something on record, talk a little bit about the court case, do amendments or begin amendments. And I would just encourage the committee members that if you have an amendment, make sure that we know well in advance of the committee. I will put it in front of the committee, you know, and maybe even hold it over, depending on if there's what the competing elements of that debate are. So, you know, we'll try to do it as deliberately as we can.
Okay. Thank you for your attention. I really appreciate it. I know some of these provisions are a little bit complicated or wordy. I appreciate your...
Well, it's a big issue, and, you know, the question of changing the culture in Alaska partly is the accountability measures that we see here. And, but there are some ticklish issues, for example, going in and being able to look at somebody or to get the subpoena for information, the Attorney General issue. I think we've debated, I think, 3 years in a row now. So we'll go another round on that. Senator Wilkowski,
yeah, just do you plan on having a CS with any? I know there are some areas where you were thinking might change based on feedback you've gotten.
I think I'll discuss it with and see what the chairman wants would like.
Yeah, and I'm open to doing that as long as once we, like, if there's tightening up the definition or anything like that, we can order a CS, highlight those, and get onto those issues so they're probably much more debatable.
Sure.
So I'm open to that. Based on the comments you got back from the committee today, we'll be in discussion. But in any case, we'll highlight them before we move forward. So no surprises in it, right? All right. Thank you very much, Attorney General, Department of Law, Department of Public Safety, Commission on Domestic Violence, students from North Pole. Thank you. Have a pleasant day. We're adjourned.